We'll start with a short meditation. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and allow your awareness to descend into your body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Tonglen is a Tibetan word meaning giving and taking. It's a very powerful method to transform our selfish, self-centered attitude into an attitude of cherishing others. To transform our attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. And we can begin by using Tonglen to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. No matter how much mental afflictions, such as attachment, anger, jealousy, craving, no matter how much of these mental afflictions are in our mind, these are just covering the surface of our mind. And underneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind. This natural purity is called our Buddha nature, our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So imagine this inner purity, this deepest dimension of your mind, in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light at the center of your chest, at the level of your heart. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I were free of suffering and its causes. May I be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine your past, present, and future suffering in the form of black smoke filling your body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing your suffering at your heart, dissolving it into your inner wisdom. And then imagine the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now you're free of all suffering and its causes. And take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I had happiness and its causes. May I be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, completely saturating your body and mind. Imagining this light turning into everything you need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to yourself whatever you need to be happy. And then imagine that you now found the genuine happiness that you seek. And take delight in this. And just as you wish to be happy and to be free of suffering, so does everybody else. So next, bring to mind someone close to you, a loved one, who's currently experiencing some kind of physical or mental problem or suffering. And picture them very clearly in front of you. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they are free of that problem, free of that suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And then imagine the black cloud of suffering is now completely extinguished. And now they're free of all suffering and its causes. Take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from your heart, filling and saturating their entire body and mind, transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. And then imagine that they've now found the true happiness that they seek. And take joy in this. And then allow your field of loving kindness and compassion to expand out further. And allow your mind to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's a loved one, someone you don't know very well, or even someone who you find a little bit difficult, attend to them. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. So arouse the thought, may you be free of all suffering and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. No matter how much darkness is drawn in, it is all extinguished without a trace. And no matter how much light is sent out, it is sent out from an inexhaustible source that is in no way depleted. So allow your mind to continue to move around. And whoever comes to mind, whether it's an individual or even a group of people, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And breathing out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting within awareness itself. Resting in the natural purity of the mind. So far here in this foundation of all good qualities, we've looked at the instructions on how to make our life meaningful at the initial level, at the foundation level, that is to simply strive for a good future in terms of adopting an ethical lifestyle. And then on top of that, this morning we had a look at how then to go to the next level of making our life meaningful, of striving not just for a good future, but to strive to break free of this cycle of samsara, to strive for the goal of liberation, of nirvana, in terms of developing this aspiration of liberation called renunciation, and then the practices of ethics, concentration, wisdom. So this is someone of middling scope or middling capacity. But then, of course, we can understand that we are not the only ones stuck in this situation. Everyone else is in the same situation. And then we can expand our scope of to make our life meaningful, of not just wishing to liberate ourselves from samsara, from suffering, but to be able to help to liberate everyone else from samsara as well. And so then we can aspire to this goal of enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from samsara. And then engage in the practices to strive for that goal of enlightenment. And so that's what we have as the next three verses here describing this. So the next verse here says, just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. So this verse here is this verse about, again, coming to see that we're not the only ones stuck in this situation, and that to develop the aspiration to help to liberate others. But of course, we can understand that in our current situation we're not much use in helping others, and that if we really want to be effective in helping others, we really need to fully develop ourselves, meaning we need to achieve enlightenment so that we can be effective in doing that. So that aspiration here that we are trying to develop is this aspiration of bodhicitta. Bodhi is enlightenment, of course. Citta is mind. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. It's the mind which aspires to the goal of enlightenment so that we can help liberate everyone from samsara. So this first verse is about how we to do that, to really develop that aspiration of bodhicitta. Now, in the Lam Rim, we find that there are two main methods presented on how we go about developing that bodhicitta aspiration, which of course again is the entry point into the Mahayana path. So the two methods are the seven cause and effect method, which in the Lam Rim is the main one that is taught. The second technique is called equalizing and exchanging self with others. Historically, in ancient India, ancient Tibet, this was the one that was most widely taught. This one was considered too difficult for the average person. But I think in our modern society, this technique often can be the more powerful technique to use. Because a reason why this one sometimes people find difficult to implement is that in this technique there is an assumption of a belief in rebirth. So of course if we don't believe in rebirth, then this could be difficult to begin to apply. Whereas of course in ancient India, ancient Tibet, there was this sort of natural assumption of rebirth. And I think this particularly can be a very powerful technique in our modern society because, again, in our modern society, we tend to really be quite self-centered, you know, a little bit narcissistic. There's always this me, me, me attitude. And this technique is directly addressing that, this sort of selfish, self-centered attitude. It's really focusing on that and working directly on reducing and transforming that into the attitude of cherishing others. And this is what the technique is saying, you know, to exchange our selfish motivation with an attitude of cherishing others. So that's the one I want to focus on here, because I think for many of us, this is probably going to be the best method. And also in this method, there's no assumption of a belief in rebirth either. So this method has 5 steps. So let's just briefly go through those so we have that a little bit clear. The first step is what's called equalizing self with others. Again, this is a very similar idea to this idea we saw in the 4 Immeasurables, the idea of equanimity. That, you know, we tend to put ourselves above everyone else. My happiness is more important than anyone else. So equalizing self with others is to put ourselves at the same level in terms of that we are all equal in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. So to reflect on that point, to really try as much as possible to put ourselves at the same level of others in that sense, in terms of equally wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. The second step is to reflect on the disadvantages of self-cherishing. This word self-cherishing here is not talking about feeling good about ourselves. Of course we need to do that. That's just loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. The word self-cherishing is another word for this selfish, self-centered attitude. My happiness more important than the happiness of anyone else. Now, it can feel like that this is necessary for us to be happy. We need to somehow really be focused on me. I'm the most important. I need to really focus on my happiness. And so it often feels like that this actually is the necessary to strive for happiness. But actually, it's the exact opposite. That this sort of putting ourselves above others in terms of importance is actually a source of a lot of suffering. For example, if we have this obsessive focus on ourselves, me and my happiness, me and my suffering, then often people who have this obsessive self-focus, then in terms of suffering, they're so obsessed about their own happiness and avoiding suffering that often then they have a lot of fear and anxiety about the world because everything out there is a potential threat to me, so I better be on guard. And so then they have often, again, a lot of fear and anxiety, and they often become very sensitive to any little thing that happens. And then to protect themselves, you know, we build this big wall around ourselves to protect ourselves. And of course, if we do that, then we cut ourselves off from the world, and then we start to feel isolated and lonely. So loneliness is another symptom of this obsessive self-focus. And then, of course, when we're obsessed about me and my happiness, then often because of that, we have a lot of attachment, a lot of craving and clinging for things, because it seems like that's what's going to give me happiness. And then, of course, if we don't get those things, we have a lot of frustration. So that's also symptomatic of this selfish attitude, a lot of frustration in our life, not getting the things we want. And even if we get the things we want, then, of course, they never really completely satisfy us. We simply end up craving for more. And we're never really completely satisfied. And so another symptom of this selfish attitude is we seem to have this big hole here that is this emptiness feeling that we need to fill. And no matter how much stuff we stick in there, it seems to even get bigger. We never really are content and happy. So that is another, you know, we have this complete dissatisfaction with everything. We're completely this hollow feeling. So this is a symptom of this selfish attitude. And also with this selfish attitude, of course, with this overinflated sense of importance, then we often show a lack of consideration and respect for others. And together with that, then, those people who seem to have more than us, of course, we become very jealous. And then also we become very competitive with others, trying to outdo them and put them down. And also then when we see others around us who seem to be, have less than us or lower level than us, we sort of get very arrogant and dismissive of them. But also, of course, then, you know, people who seem to stand in the way of our happiness, then we'll even go to the extent of harming those who get in the way of our happiness. So if we harm others in the pursuit of our happiness, then generally they harm us back. But also, of course, we understand that harming others is not really the right thing to do. And so if we do that because of this selfish motivation, driven by that, then we often have a lot of guilt feelings as well. And as I said before, with this very narrow perspective of simply looking at each situation from how is this situation affecting me, then again, we, you know, divide the people into those three groups. We end up with a lot of attachment to friends because they seem to be the source of my happiness. Apathy, indifference to strangers because they don't seem to affect me in any way. And a lot of aversion, hostility, anger and hatred to the difficult people. So these are the things that really come out of this selfish, self-centered attitude. And unfortunately, our modern materialistic society tends to promote this idea a lot, and it really gets us nowhere, and it gets us backwards and gets us into a lot of suffering. So to see this, to reflect on this, we'll come to see that actually, rather than this self-cherishing being our best friend bringing us happiness, it's actually our worst enemy bringing us all of our suffering. And then we'll want to let go of that selfish motivation. And then it's good to reflect, as I mentioned earlier as well, to reflect on the positive opposite. Is to reflect on the advantages of cherishing others, which of course is the exact opposite of this, meaning that if we are really cherishing others, we won't have this obsessive self-focus, which means we won't have a lot of this fear and anxiety about the world, being overly sensitive, having to build a big wall around ourselves, protecting ourselves, and thereby feeling a lot of isolation or loneliness. Through cherishing others, of course, we'll feel very much connected with the world and connected with other people. Also then we won't be obsessed about me and my happiness, which means we won't have all this craving for things, frustration when we don't get those things, disappointment, dissatisfaction when they don't live up to our expectations. All of this will be very much reduced and disappear. And also, of course, we won't have an overinflated, exaggerated sense of self-importance, which means that instead of getting jealous with others who have more than us, we'll be happy, we're rejoicing. We won't be competitive, trying to outdo people, put them down. We'll actually be helping people, particularly if they seem to have less than us. And we won't have this very narrow perspective of how is this situation just affecting me, which means we won't have attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, and aversion, hostility, anger, and hatred to difficult people. We'll equally be having this mind of equanimity and then equally having loving kindness and compassion towards others and really trying to help others as much as we can. So these are really the advantages of cherishing others. So if we reflect on these two together, we're going to really want to let go of and get rid of our self-cherishing mind and really cultivate the mind of cherishing others as much as possible. Now, with every practice, of course, for any practice to be effective, practice has to have two parts. There has to be a formal meditation practice, which is internalizing these ideas, transforming our mind. But at the same time, practice involves integrating into daily life. If we want any practice to be effective, we need to do both of these things, internalize and integrate. And so in this practice here, the next two points cover both of those. The fourth one is, exchanging self with others, is what we do in daily life. So that's the integration part. And so, of course, what we're doing here is then in daily life, in our behavior, when we notice some selfish motivation coming up, we immediately recognize that and then transform that as best we can, let go of that and transform that into an attitude of cherishing others and then engage in the behavior. Now here we, of course, need to be very practical. Of course, the final goal is to have zero self-cherishing and really just cherishing others. But we won't be able to do that overnight. And often then people, what they do here is when they're going to do something, and it may even be something good, then they notice, oh, I'm doing this with a little bit of a selfish motivation. I'm not supposed to do that. Okay, I won't do it. And so they stop themselves from engaging in virtuous behavior because they notice a little bit of selfishness. I think this is not a very good approach, because actually now I think for us it's almost impossible to do any good behavior without any self-cherishing. Even if it's the thing of, you know, if we're doing something good, expecting people to say thank you. So rather than stopping ourselves because we notice a little bit of selfishness when we're trying to do something good, of course, first thing is to notice that there's a selfish motivation creeping in, and then as much as we can try and reduce it, but then still do the good action. And this is what His Holiness often calls smart selfishness. You know, he often talks about trying to be unselfish, but, you know, he understands that for us to do that without any selfishness now is almost impossible. And he often says then, okay, if you have to be selfish, at least be selfish in a smart way. Smart selfishness says, my happiness is a little bit dependent on the people around me, so if I want to be happy, I really need to look after them, because then they're more likely to do good things for me. That's smart selfishness. Dumb selfishness, of course, is behaving badly to the people around us, and then they will, of course, react to that and harm us. So smart selfishness is saying, okay, I want to be happy, then I need to look after the people around me, and so therefore the smart selfishness would be doing good things, expecting something in return. That's already an improvement on harming the people around us. So then we do that, and then as much as we can reduce the selfish motivation. And what you will find is over time, the joy you get from just merely helping them will be much more than anything, getting anything in return. So you'll find that the selfish motivation will naturally decrease over time, and eventually you'll be able to completely get rid of all selfish motivation. So I think we need to be very practical in this way. So there's a very nice quote I like related to this, which goes like the following here. It says, in terms of exchanging this attitude in daily life, and that is, when I am hungry, give me someone that I can feed. And when I am thirsty, give me someone who needs a drink. And when I am cold, give me someone to keep warm. And when I grieve, give me someone to console. So that's from Mother Teresa, so maybe she was onto something there. Another very short line I like here related to this, another quote is, only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. Only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. And that comes from Albert Einstein, so I think he was onto something as well. So this is what we do in terms of daily life. But if we really want this process to be effective, we also need to internalize. We need to transform our mental attitude. So this is, of course, is our verbal and physical behavior, but we also need to work on our mental attitude, and we can transform that effectively in meditation. So the meditation then is the meditation we just did, just previously, and that is tonglen, which is a Tibetan word meaning giving and taking, where we are imagining taking on the suffering of others and then imagining giving all happiness away to them. And it's a very powerful method to really reduce our self-cherishing mind and increase the mind of cherishing others. Because the last thing self-cherishing would want to do would be to take on suffering from anybody. Any suffering from anybody. The last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to give away any happiness to anyone. So it really does, it's a very direct method to really weaken that self-cherishing mind and strengthen the mind of cherishing others. And this tonglen meditation is very widely practiced in, I think, all the Tibetan traditions. It's one of the really core practices. Now, often when people do this practice initially, they have a little bit of hesitation. And one of the things is, if I have someone there who's got some sort of serious illness and I imagine taking that on, will I get the sickness, the illness? And of course the answer is no, because this is a mental exercise. We can't actually take their sickness from them. But then when that's explained, people go, well, then what's the point if I can't actually take any sickness or suffering from people? The main point, of course, of this exercise is to use this exercise to reduce and eliminate our self-cherishing mind and to increase the mind of cherishing others, our mind of loving kindness and compassion. Which means if we're effectively doing this practice, then outside the meditation, we're more likely to help people in a very more genuine way. So that's going to be the result of this practice. But also, we should not underestimate the power of the mind, and that if we really are just mentally doing this exercise in meditation, then I think we can have a direct positive impact on that person's mind, even if they're on the other side of the planet. And I think there is some scientific evidence to back that up. And certainly from a Buddhist perspective, because of the interconnected nature of reality, then this is definitely possible. That particularly if we have some connection with that person, then we can, through that mental exercise, have a direct positive impact on their mind at a very subtle level. So we should not underestimate that either. So this is the tonglen practice that we did. And so these are the two practices we can do together to really reduce their self-cherishing, increase the mind of cherishing others. So this is the equalizing and exchanging self with others practice. Any questions about that?
You've mentioned that we cannot really take the problems of the suffering of another being, but I have heard about experiments when a person was hypnotized into thinking that he was being touched by some very hot object, and it was actually quite a lukewarm object, for example, a stick. But after this hypnotic session, he had blisters on his
feet. Sure.
And the same, I also heard about cases when lamas or monks were doing this exercise to help, for example, the relatives of in some family who had died and were supposed to be in hell, and he was taking the suffering, their suffering in the hell realm, and was also getting some sort of burns on his skin.
Yeah. So there's a difference between using the power of the mind to then create some sort of experience versus transferring someone's karma to you. So I think even in these situations, we can't transfer the karma. What we can do is, through the power of the mind, we can have those sorts of experiences, but it's not a transference as such. Of course, at a physical level, we can have a physical impact on others, positive and negative, you know, like healing, you know, energetic work. But that's just at a physical level. And so, of course, here we're talking karma is at the mental level of taking that imprint from them. So we can't really take that, because actually the proof of that is if it was possible to take someone's karma on, then we'd all be enlightened now, because the Buddha is the ultimate compassionate being. He would have taken everyone's negative karma and suffering from them. We wouldn't be suffering now. So, yes, we can. The power of the mind, as you said, in the scientific experiments is immense. But that's different than actually transferring things from one person to another. So I think that's not really what we're... So that's something a little bit different. And, yes, that's certainly possible according to Buddhist understanding.
But then we get a situation when both of us actually suffer.
What's that?
I mean, if we do not take the suffering of the other being,
but
still we ourselves get the sort of the experience of suffering.
But again, so remember here...
No.
So again, here, that's why we have to understand what this process is that we are imagining taking that on. So what's really going on here is that we're developing a willingness to do that. That willingness to do that is what is destroying our self-cherishing mind. So that's what's really going on here. That's why it's important to, when you're imagining taking on this black smoke or however you visualize it, we're not imagining taking that black smoke and then holding it. We're imagining, in fact, that the willingness to take the suffering is what is really destroying the self-cherishing. And that is symbolized by that black smoke dissolving into that light, if we do it that way, into the inner wisdom that is being dissolved. Because it's that attitude that destroys the suffering. So we're not imagining holding that suffering in our body. Because as you said, the mind is a very powerful thing. So we, you know, and, you know, there's a very nice quote from a modern day philosopher, William James, who says, what we attend to becomes our reality. And so in our society, of course, we always focus on the negative, and so that becomes our reality. And so, of course, if we simply sit here and imagine that, you know, poor me, sick me, whatever, then we will produce that in the body. But that's not what this meditation is about. So this is the, you know, the idea of hypnosis and imagining that we're being burnt. I mean, we can then produce that, but this is not what we're doing here. And so we should not be doing that here, because otherwise we've missed the point of this whole exercise. The point is not for us to suffer. The point is to transform our mental state. That's what we're doing. That's why if we do it like this, then we are focusing on dissolving that, and we're focusing then on the positive. And then that's the correct method here. So that's what this meditation is about.
So we should not miss the dissolving.
That's right, correct. Yeah, because we often do that, you know. And this is, again, cognitive fusion, isn't it? You know, if we have some negative thing happening in our body or mind, we identify with that and we hold on to that. Of course, that just makes more suffering. So we don't want to do that. And that's not the... Then we're missing really the point of this meditation, what the purpose is of it.
How important is this visualization of smoke and light?
again, with all of these sorts of meditations, and similarly in Tantra, getting the clear visualization is not the most important thing. The most important thing is what's going on in the mind, the attitude. So if you can't visualize very clearly, don't worry. The most important thing is having the sense of wanting to take that from them and wanting to give the happiness. That's the key element. Whether or not you can see them clearly or whatever, that's not so important. Of course, if you can see clearly, it may have more impact, but it's not the main thing. So don't worry about that, because many people have difficulty visualizing, you know, they're very hazy. So don't worry. The main thing, again, is the what's going on in the mind in terms of the attitude.
But could I then just focus on the attitude and not at all this visualization?
Sure. If you find that effective, then no, you don't need to do the visualization. But I think often people find that the visualization makes it more sort of easy to focus on, because if we don't visualize, then we're not sort of with, see, our visual sense and also imagination is very powerful, and it can really lock us in. Whereas if we're not doing that and we're trying to just mentally do this, it may be much more easy to get distracted. So you may find that the visualization also helps us to be more focused. So for that reason too. Okay, then, so this is the two techniques for developing this mind of bodhicitta, which is what is being mentioned here in this verse, that please bless me to see this train in supreme bodhicitta and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. So this is the aspiration that we are trying to develop, and then on that basis, of course, then we need to engage in the training. What is the training to train in the goal of enlightenment? We remember we saw in that chart yesterday, there's six perfections. And within those six perfections, we could also condense those six perfections into the same three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And so here we see in the next verse, like the previous section, that the basis of the Mahayana path is also ethics. And we see that in the next verse, which says, even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. So here, the three types of morality or ethics is that, remember we saw that at the foundation level of the Four Noble Truths, the ethics there effectively was abandoning non-virtuous actions, abandoning harming others. Whereas here in the Mahayana, the ethics is more proactive. And we mentioned that yesterday in the Six Perfections. So here, ethics, there's these three types of ethics. The foundation, again, is the ethics of abandoning non-virtue. The second type of ethics here then is the ethics of engaging in virtue, and then also the ethics of benefiting others. So these are what's described here as the three types of morality or three types of ethics. So the ethics in the Mahayana, again, is much more proactive. So the ethics of not just abandoning non-virtue, but engaging in virtue, and the ethics of benefiting others. So that's what's being mentioned here. So what this is saying is that we won't get to enlightenment simply by having the aspiration of bodhicitta. We need to engage in the six perfections practices. In particular here, as a foundation for that, we need to engage in the perfection of ethics. And again, within that ethics in the Mahayana, we can also have here what's called the bodhisattva vows. So at the foundation level, to help support our practice, to help enable us to be ethical, we had those pratimoksha vows. Here, in terms of supporting our bodhicitta, supporting our practice of the six perfections, we have the bodhisattva vows, which made up of what's called 18 root vowels and 46 secondary vowels. And in those vowels again are to help understand what to avoid and what to practice to be able to support us to sustain bodhicitta and to help support us in all of the practices of the six perfections. So that's what it means here about help me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. To use that as the basis for enabling us to effectively practice all of these six perfections and to support the mind of bodhicitta so it doesn't degenerate. Any questions on that verse? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, true. When it says develop only bodhicitta, then of course we can talk about that at some different levels. Of course now we can try to cultivate bodhicitta, and this is what's called contrived bodhicitta. Meaning we do these sorts of reflections, and then from that we have this aspiration, oh yes, I'd really like to achieve enlightenment to help others. And so we need to sort of try and cultivate that. And we may be able to hold that for a little while and then we sort of forget it and we go back to our normal habits. But we keep working on that and try and make that more and more stable, to the point where it becomes what's called uncontrived bodhicitta. And that uncontrived bodhicitta, that means that this motivation of bodhicitta is something that is naturally coming up and spontaneously coming up throughout the day. And all of our activities are really, have that motivation. When we get to that point, we have entered the Mahayana path. Prior to that, of course, it's not so stable. And prior to that, we would then, take these bodhisattva vows to enable us to help develop that bodhicitta and help us to start to practice those six perfections. So, yes, of course, we need, even from the very beginning, to have ethical basis to develop that bodhicitta. But I think here what it's saying is that, in a broader sense, is that if we really even fully develop bodhicitta, but then we don't work on those six perfections practices, we're not going to get to enlightenment. So I think it's not just talking about the second of the six perfections of ethics, but I think implicitly it's saying that, well, you know, okay, you got the bodhicitta, but now you need to practice these six perfections if you really want to strive for the goal of enlightenment. So you're definitely correct in that, even to get to that bodhicitta, we need to try as best we can to practice ethics and the bodhisattva vows for sure. Anything else?
So what would the 18 root vowels be then?
Do you have, Nico, that little booklet, the bodhisattva vows, the thin booklet? Because there's a very nice thin booklet that the FPMT has produced that has a list of all the 18, the 46, and how to hold them and what it means to break them. And it's a very nice little booklet. So the best thing would be to read that. Because there's a whole big list of things in the 18. And it's a little bit beyond this course here this weekend. Because often people present just that as a whole course. Oh, you've got it? No, you can. Because actually now it's time for afternoon tea break. So let's have afternoon tea break. Come back at 3, and then we're going to go to the next verse where it says, once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing meaning reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding special insight. This verse here is talking about the other two core practices of concentration and wisdom. So this is the shamatha vipassana practice, which now I'm going to talk about in some detail this afternoon, and then continue to talk about that tomorrow evening. So these are really essential core practices, and we're going to spend a bit of time on those. But that's coming up in the next session. So let's have a tea break first.